Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
From Cosmos Magazine, the first cow to produce human insulin has been created in Brazil.
Huh.
Yeah, we have Island of Dr. Moreau, a cow to make human insulin in its milk. So how cool would that be if that were like a truly effective delivery system for the world's diabetics, assuming they also don't have lactose intolerance, right?
Yeah.
What does it do to the cow?
Well, let's put cow in air quotes, only because this animal is transgenic. That means it has DNA from another species, and specifically it was some of ours.
Oh, wait, this is a cow. Wow, human high. Okay.
This is truly Island Dr. Moreau.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That's not
like,
cool.
I was kind of exaggerating, but I was also kind of not, right?
Wow.
Because, yeah, this is research led by one Matt Wheeler, professor in the Department of Animal Sciences at the University of Illinois, right here in the good old US of A. And the scientists are saying that this particular research took advantage of the special factors of the mammary gland. And that's because Mother Nature designed the mammary gland as a factory to make protein super efficiently. Now, this insulin-producing cow, they're actually calling it a proof of concept. But they're hoping could one day be scaled up to produce enough insulin to supply the world's diabetics. According to the head researcher, quote, I could see a future where a 100-head herd could produce all the insulin needed for the country. And a larger herd, you could make the whole world supply in a year. Some of the math on that probably needs to be mathed a little bit more, but
yeah.
Here's how it happened. Wheeler's colleagues at the University of Sao Paulo in Brazil inserted a segment of human DNA coding for proinsulin. That's the precursor of the active form of insulin. And they did that in the cell nuclei of 10 cow embryos. Those were then implanted in the uteruses of normal cows, which resulted in the birth of one transgenic cow.
Wow.
Now, this sounds kind of old school, but believe it or not, the technology has gotten way better because in the old days, and this is a quote from the scientist, we used to just slam DNA in and hope it got expressed where you wanted it to.
Okay, well, that's better than what I thought they were trying to do. My brain went, oh, it's, yeah.
No.
Those olden days, no, we don't want to talk about those. But today, we can be a lot more strategic and targeted with how and where we are inserting DNA. So we used a DNA construct specific to mammary tissue, which meant that there's no human insulin circulating in the cow's blood or other tissues. They were able to keep it localized within the animal. And it also takes advantage of the mammary gland's capabilities for producing large quantities of protein. They did try to impregnate the cow once she had reached maturity, but those attempts were unsuccessful.
Mm.
And because the milk volume was smaller than expected due to the fact they had to induce lactation via hormones, the researchers can't say exactly how much insulin could be made in a typical lactation because the data they got was from atypical lactation, right?
Right.
So they've done some math, but it's just a little kind of garbage in, garbage out. But the team now has plans to reclone the cow and attempt pregnancy and full lactation cycles in the next generation. Eventually, they hope to create transgenic bulls to mate with the females, creating transgenic offspring that could be used to establish a purpose-built herd.
And do any of us know how we produce artificial insulin today? I don't. I was just curious to see if any of you all knew.
Well, they referred to transgenic yeast and bacteria, but yeah, it's kind of puzzling given how expensive it remains, at least here in the U.S.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the olden days, I know that basically you could take it from a sheep or another animal, but you had to kill the animal to get it. So it was like a limited, you couldn't just have this ongoing process, which obviously, you know, if they're able to make the cows do this, I guess it's okay. But also, if you've got to genetically modify the cow and then inject it with hormones, I feel like there's going to be a problem somewhere along the way.
Yeah. And boy, let's not even get into the ethics of that. Like,
Yeah. We've already thrown all that out the window.
I will say that the article did end with a poll quote that's worth repeating in full. Quote, "We know what we're doing with cows," which to me felt so sus because if you have to say that out loud, I don't know, man. All right. Next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from TheGuardian.com. It's titled, "Dogs Can Understand the Meaning of Nouns, New Research Finds."
I mean, we kind of already knew, like food, walkies.
Yeah, like do they understand, I guess they're saying they understand the concept of a noun as opposed to like my dog understands words?
Yeah, that's what they're trying to figure out. Do they know like the general idea of a ball, or does ball just mean, you know, my favorite salivaed up, torn in half
tennis ball, right?
So dogs understand what certain words stand for, according to researchers who monitored the brain activity of willing pooches while they were shown balls, slippers, leashes, and other highlights of the domestic canine world, which sounds like a pretty sweet gig if you're a dog. A survey in 2022 found that dog owners believed their furry companion responded to between 15 and 215 words.
Wow.
More direct evidence for canine cognitive prowess came in 2011 when psychologists in South Carolina reported that after 3 years of intensive training, a border collie called Chaser had learned the names of more than 1,000 objects, including 800 cloth toys, 116 balls, and 26 frisbees.
Wow.
Have you all seen his videos? They are awesome.
Where they're like, go get the green spiky ball and he can go pick it out.
They'll also show just a picture of the green spiky ball and it'll go get the green spiky ball.
What?
Wow.
Then they can put a brand new toy in there that it hasn't seen yet. And he'll say, go get Einstein. And it'll go back in the back of its like 500 toys and find the one that has no name yet and pull that one. It's a remarkable dog, though.
Okay.
So thinking that our dogs can do that is like thinking that I can do Einstein stuff, right?
Yeah, and like I've seen those videos of dogs that have those word pads where they can spell out full sentences, and you know, hard to tell whether or not the dog actually understands language and is purposely constructing grammar or just repeating to get a treat or whatever.
Yes.
But it's pretty wild and very impressive with the smarter dogs.
Mm-hmm.
So at the lab, the owners were instructed to say words for objects before showing their dog either the correct item or a different one. The experiments were repeated multiple times with matching and non-matching objects. During the tests, researchers monitored the dog's brain activity through non-invasive electroencephalography, or EEG. The traces revealed different patterns of activity when the objects matched or clashed with the words their owner said. Similar blips in EEG recordings were seen when humans performed the tests and were interpreted as people understanding a word well enough to form a mental representation that was either confirmed or confounded by the object they were subsequently shown. The scientists say the results provide the first neural evidence for object word knowledge in a non-human animal. The study raises the question of why, if dogs understand certain nouns, more of them don't show it. One possibility is that a dog knows what a word refers to, but is not bothered about acting on it. Boro said, "My dog only cares about his ball. If I bring him another toy, he doesn't care about it at all." Which, I mean, I feel like that's absolutely the case for cats. I'm pretty sure they understand everything we say. They just don't care.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Holly Root Guttridge, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Lincoln who wasn't involved in the study, called the work fascinating. She said, "It's particularly interesting because I think it's unlikely this started during domestication, so it may be widespread throughout mammals. That's highly exciting in itself as it shines new light on language evolution. It might be that dogs don't really care enough about a game of fetch, this particular thing, to play along with the way we've been training and testing them so far."
Yeah, none of my dogs enjoy fetch at all. You can try and show it to them and they're like, "Why would you throw that away? Like, you that makes no sense what you just did.
You just made work
Didn't
for me.
Didn't you need that?"
Yeah.
And on the border collie, that guy spent, I'd say, 16 hours a day with that dog training.
Sure.
The dog
Yeah. Wow. The dog was cramming and taking Adderall. And
he was retired and that became his full time obsession kind of thing.
So I'm not going to get my dog to learn those things you're saying.
Probably.
I had my hopes, but.
Well, you've got some work ahead of you. And
Oh, this involves work for me? I'm out. Not happening.
just call Caesar and have him come over and fix it.
Exactly.
Next link.
Next link.
From The Guardian. Swedish composer becomes Spotify's most famous musician you've never heard of.
Oh.
A secret composer has been identified as Sweden's most listened to artist on Spotify, pulling in more plays than Britney Spears or ABBA.
Huh.
His name is Johan Roer. And why haven't you heard of him?
I mean, now I have, so the article's wrong.
The Stockholm-based musician has only recently been unmasked as the person behind more than 650 different artists on the streaming service.
What?
Who has been played more than 15 billion times. According to Swedish newspaper DN, which identified the 47-year-old, Roher has created more than 2,700 songs on the platform under names including, oh, and I'm going to butcher these, but here we go, Maya Astrom, Minik Kundersen, and there's a lot of C's and Z's in that last one. So even by international standards, his success of the multiple identities puts him among Spotify's top 100 most streamed artists, above Michael Jackson, Metallica, and Mariah Carey.
Wow.
So what genre do y'all think?
I mean, I would have guessed that all 650 were different, and that was how he was, you know, you got to keep your brand separate. No. But are you telling me they're all the same?
Is it like new age background music stuff?
Yep.
Yeah,
yep.
That makes sense. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Instrumental. Here's some of the names of the songs. Peaceful Piano.
Ah.
Stress Relief.
Yep.
That's the name of the song. Stress relief.
Hey, oh, yeah. Listen, when you need a jam to unwind to and those are the keywords you're searching for, Swedish guy delivers.
Yeah. As someone who routinely turns on a 10-hour YouTube video of white noise, I get it. Like,
Relaxation music apparently sells. Well, not sells, streams. Now, let's get into the money part. And this is where, as an independent musician myself, it gets a little gray and disingenuous with how much he made from all the streams.
Mm-hmm.
Because Spotify just celebrated paying out a record £6.7 billion to the music industry.
Mm-hmm. Which still wasn't enough, right?
Yeah, more on that in a second. But first, let's hear it from Daniel Ek, the owner of Spotify, who, full disclosure, I'm not a huge fan of, says, quote, many new and promising artists are now breaking through on Spotify and can finally make a full-time living from music.
In that you continue to live and haven't died yet. However, you have no money.
Now, this isn't in the article, but this needs to be said. Spotify pays artists between 0.003 to 0.005 per stream.
Yeah, fractions of a penny.
And remember, too, the rights holders of songs can include, like, the publisher, the songwriter, the mastering engineer, the recording engineers. They only get a smaller percentage of that.
Mm-hmm.
Critics also agree that the success of just a few anonymous artists like Roer, who quietly dominate the market, is against the spirit of the company's promise to help small independent musicians and record companies and composers. We don't know how much he made, but his private company reportedly made $2.4 million in 2022.
Wow.
He declined to comment, but Overtone Studios, the label that released the music, said that Roer was, quote, a pioneer in the mood music genre, and confirmed that he had used multiple names. And Spotify said it did not comment on agreements it has with distributors, but that artists are permitted to use pseudonyms.
Well, and I think they keep trying to make this about, no, he used multiple identities, but that's okay. That's not what it's about. That's not what anybody cares about.
That's not the point. Yeah.
They're like, you're not paying enough.
Mm-hmm. Had to game the system. And again, I'm totally fine with artists using pseudonyms. I've got three different bands streaming myself, so I'd be a bit of a hypocrite. But yeah, again, the gaming the system, that he had to game the system.
Yep.
And I'd also like to point out, too, that Spotify uses payola in their playlist curation. They pay playlist people to put their artists at the top of that playlist. So the labels are still gaming the Spotify playlist. So if you really want to support your musicians, please go buy their albums, go buy their merch, go to the shows. Yep. Support them and us on Patreon.
Send them some DoorDash, you know, show up at their house and mow their lawn, whatever. Like,
take pictures of them
local.
Right as they leave their homes every day.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Next link.
Next link.
All right. This next one is from SmithsonianMag.com, and it's called This Extremely Rare Neurological Condition Makes Faces Appear Like a Demon.
Oh, yeah.
Have y'all seen these pictures going around? The pictures have been on a lot of formats, but the story itself is actually pretty interesting. So we start with a man named Victor Shara, who woke up one morning feeling completely fine, other than the fact that his roommate's face had suddenly changed.
Yeah.
The corners of his roommate's eyes and mouth were pulled way back, his ears were pointy, and he had deep grooves in his forehead.
Right, looking like a demon.
Shara said it looked like, quote, something out of a Star Trek movie, and was understandably terrified. Fortunately, Shara was able to keep his cool and sort of inherently understood that this was a problem with what he was seeing and not something that was real. He tried to explain to his roommate what was going on, and the roommate, quote, thought I was nuts.
How much acid had he been on
to
stay that calm with that, right?
Yeah. So he went to the doctor and then probably several more doctors and was eventually diagnosed with prosopometamorphopsia, or PMO, which is an extremely rare neurological disorder that causes human faces to appear distorted. PMO was first described in 1904, and fewer than 100 cases have been confirmed since. And while everyone with PMO does see faces and only faces being horribly distorted, the way in which they're distorted can vary dramatically. Some people with the condition see faces as being droopy, discolored, oddly textured, or with specific features moved to a different part of the face. But whatever they see it consistently. It's sort of like synesthesia, where that's what faces are to them.
Like having a setting where every face you look at is like a Picasso painting. Just
yeah,
like
pretty much.
But like in the same aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. So not surprisingly, most doctors have never heard of this condition. And it is often misdiagnosed as schizophrenia or psychosis. The major difference is that someone with PMO has no delusions and is completely aware that what they're seeing isn't real. And some doctors actually think that this may lead to a certain amount of underdiagnosis, because people who develop PMO are often afraid to tell anyone what they're seeing because they don't want to get hospitalized. They're like, I'm fully aware this is fake, but also if I say out loud, everyone looks like a demon, we know what happens after that. But we're doing our part here, spreading the word, and so is Shara, because one of the interesting aspects of PMO is that it only applies to real-world 3D faces. When Shara looks at a photo of a person, it looks completely normal.
Huh.
So Antonio Mello, a neuroscientist at Dartmouth College, had an idea. He sat Shara down with a series of people and opened up pictures of those same people in Photoshop. The picture looked normal, the person didn't, and Shara was able to talk an artist through changing the faces in Photoshop until they appeared to him the way the real person did. And yes, the pictures are in the article, and it is a pretty classic demon face. You know, it definitely feels like it's got to be one of the worst kinds of distortion you could have. Because, like, I think if you woke up and people were just blue or their noses were on their forehead or whatever, it wouldn't be great, but it wouldn't be as disturbing as what Shara sees.
Right, almost like Gollum from the pictures.
Yeah. Wow. As for what causes PMO, doctors aren't certain, but it usually develops after some kind of trauma to the brain, whether that's a stroke, an infection, a tumor, or a good old-fashioned injury. Sometimes, though, it just strikes without warning. In Shara's case, the only possible culprits are that about 4 months before his symptoms started, he suffered from carbon monoxide poisoning.
Oh.
And more than a decade earlier, he did experience a severe head injury after a fall. PMO can also mysteriously go away on its own after a few weeks or months, or sometimes, like in Shara's case, it can last for many years. Fortunately, it turns out that PMO can also sometimes be treated. For Shara, he discovered through extensive trial and error that, for him, adjusting the color of light around him to a specific shade of green makes faces appear normal again.
What?
Yeah. So a friend had a pair of glasses made for him with that exact lens color, which basically makes them the opposite of the They Live sunglasses, right? Like, everybody's looking like a demon, and you put these glasses on, it's like, oh, cool, 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 cool.
What?
Yeah, I went and rewatched the They Live segment after reading this.
Good old Roddy Piper.
Exactly. And it's really sweet here at the end. As luck would have it, the glasses arrived in the mail on the exact day that Shara was going to meet his baby granddaughters for the first time, so he got to see them on day one as they truly were.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is, again, a horrifying thing to think about, is also babies look like little demons. Like,
oh,
it's
my
just
God.
A horrible disease.
They do to me, so I don't know. That maybe
just naturally.
I mean, have we considered that he just had the scales fall from his eyes and he's just seeing everyone how we really are?
He's the only one. No, you start talking like that, now you're in the hospital.
Oh,
see?
Okay. Yes. All right. Yep. Asking the wrong questions. Okay.
And then it goes away on itself, too. Like, the brain just remarkably elastic.
Well, and the fact that facial recognition is in a completely different part of the brain compared to identifying any other object. Like, it really speaks to how human faces evolutionarily are very important to us. And that's also, it's connected to, like, why you sometimes see faces in random objects, like the sink faucets or whatever. Yeah. We really, really want to see faces and want to interpret faces as special, which, you know, I guess they are. They're fine. Picasso wasn't into them, but... Next link.
Next link.
All right. From NPR, some good news. A family found centuries-old Okinawan art that was stolen during World War II in their attic. No, hold on. They found the stuff in their attic. They didn't steal the stuff in their attic. Again, preface.
Right. These weren't the people who stole them. They just found the stolen painting.
Just trying to get away with it. Like, we found it. It's not ours.
It's not mine. I'm holding it for a friend.
Did my great-grandfather fight in the war? Look, we don't need to talk about that.
All right, well, you've spoiled my story utterly, because tucked away in the attic of a Massachusetts home was not one, not two, but 22 pieces of stolen Japanese antiques, including a hand-drawn map, ceramics, portraits of Okinawan kings, some dating as far back as the 1700s. The items were found last year inside the residence of a World War II veteran whose children were sorting through his belongings after he passed away, according to the FBI. The family did the right thing and later alerted the authorities. And the FBI announced that the artifacts have successfully made their way back to Japan. And according to the FBI, the objects took the family by surprise, mostly because their father, that World War II veteran, had never served in the Pacific Theater.
He was holding him for a friend.
Literally, I think that's what it was. So they did some research when they found this. They were like, why is this here? He didn't even go to the Pacific Theater. They found that some of the items in their father's possession had been entered into the FBI's National Stolen Art File. It's a searchable database, and it's there to help the public and law enforcement determine if an item was ever stolen. Now, in 1945, during the Battle of Okinawa in World War II, a ton of documents and treasures from the Ryukyu Kingdom were taken. In 2001, Japanese officials registered the missing items with the U.S. National Stolen Art File, and the FBI said that inside the Massachusetts home was an unsigned typewritten letter stating that the items were collected in Okinawa during the last days of World War II.
What?
It's pillaging. We've had a lot of different 100%. Rebrands of it over the years, but, you know, collecting, whatever you want to say.
I'm just trying to figure out why you would type up a note that's like, I stole these.
It's not to confess. It's for provenance. It's for value.
Oh, it's just straight up like, yes.
Need to have documentation saying this is what it actually is and where it came from. But if it's unsigned, even that document would have been sus. So my guess, based on how this read, was like he was holding it for a friend, definitely did not even want to risk trying to sell or offload them, and kids did the right thing.
Or somebody else had them. They're like, hey, our grandfather just died. He fought in World War II, so we can pin this on him. And only later, they were like, he never served in the Pacific Theater. And you're like, what? You mean somehow.
He must have got him. Right. Switched him out for some German art.
He traded
German art for Japanese stuff.
Well, good on the family for recognizing, hey, this probably is stolen. Because I can imagine you go through like your grandparents' attic. Oh, he's got some art. Cool. Let's get it appraised. And all of a sudden the FBI is swooping in and you have no idea.
Do you think the FBI just hangs out at the Antiques Roadshow? Just waiting.
I bet they have a couple. I bet there's some low-level agents who, like, they're like, listen, we gotta put you on some kind of unimportant duty. Go to the Antiques Roadshow.
I really want to wait for something to pop up.
That is such a, like, heist blockbuster waiting to happen. Like, the geriatric. Okay, I'll write it because no one else is responding to this. It'll make more sense when I've got the script. All right.
No, I think I get it.
Uh-huh. But it's like, the old man can't run that fast, so the FBI agent has to walk after him. Like, just to make the chase scene.
it could be done. This has a lot of legs. Okay, next link.
next link.
This article comes to us from sciencealert.com. It's titled, First of Its Kind Quantum Tornado Achieves Record-Breaking Black Hole Mimicry.
That sounds fun and good.
Mm-hmm. And I'll spoil it for y'all up front. It's not anything really like a real black hole in terms of something that can open up and swallow the world.
Okay.
It's just they mimicked some key properties of it. So black holes are quite probably the weirdest, most extreme objects in a whole universe of very weird things. They're also notoriously difficult to study. They don't emit any radiation we can detect. We can only see light from the space immediately around them. One way we can learn more about them is by creating black hole analogs. One type of black hole analog is a vortex or whirlpool. Any material that comes close enough to a black hole starts to swirl around it and then fall onto it like water circling and gurgling down a drain. So apt is this comparison that scientists have even built water vortices to study black hole behavior. Physicist Patrick Svankara of the University of Nottingham in the UK wanted to take this a step further with superfluid helium. This is an isotope of helium, helium-4, that has been cooled to minus 271 degrees Celsius, or minus 456 Fahrenheit, just slightly above absolute zero. So, very cold. At this extremely cold temperature, the bosons in helium-4 slow down enough to overlap and behave as one superatom. And it's kind of hard to imagine what this means exactly, tangibly speaking, but I guess it's kind of like if you were sliding down water, instead of feeling it rush under you and kind of bounce on the water and all that, you just like instantly zoom down the slide on top of the water. I don't know. That's kind of my guess.
Well, it's pulling you apart.
Yeah. As that's happening. Right. And you're freezing to death instantly. So the team harnessed the unusual quantum properties of superfluid helium-4 to generate a sort of quantum tornado. By studying this tornado, the researchers were able to identify similarities between the vortex flow and the influence of a spinning black hole on the curved space-time around it. In particular, the researchers observed standing waves analogous to black hole bound states and excitations analogous to the ring down of a newly formed black hole.
Sure.
And if you're curious about more of the details on all of these, there are plenty of links to this article, like every other sentence, because black holes are complicated.
Right.
A lot of science that goes into them, or comes out of them, ironically speaking.
Right.
So this is just the start. Now that the researchers have demonstrated that their experiments work the way they intended, the vortex is poised to unlock a new area of black hole science. Physicist Silk Weinfertner of the University of Nottingham says, "We have taken this research to the next level, which could eventually lead us to predict how quantum fields behave in curved spacetimes around astrophysical black holes."
Well, that sounds useful.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the end result of this. Maybe this is us getting closer to, you know, time warp, space-time bending technology or something like that. Or, you know, just science is fun and it's fascinating to learn about the universe.
Yeah, it's the latter, probably. Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
Speaking of space, this is from The Bite. China working on giant railgun to shoot astronauts into space.
Oh,
no. Really?
Well, they can definitely sell tickets to that.
Chinese scientists are working on a giant electromagnetic launch track to launch a massive 50-ton space plane larger than a Boeing 737 into orbit.
Launching a plane is way better than launching a person. Like, I was imagining a human cannonball kind of thing.
They're still wanting to stick humans in it.
Okay, but still, like, we strap humans to a bunch of rockets. There's a a container.
I see. Yeah, the title, it's just, I get it.
Yep.
Okay.
Super Dave. You were thinking Super Dave.
Yeah, exactly.
Super Dave Oz, we just shoot him into space. Yeah. But back to the railgun. As the China Morning Post reports, the giant railgun system is designed to accelerate a hypersonic aircraft to speeds of up to Mach 1.6. Once it reaches the end of the track, its engines then accelerate it to the edge of space at 7 times the speed of sound. They don't say how long the railgun is or how long it'll take to accelerate to Mach 1.6, because that's roughly 1,200 miles an hour for the non-airplane nerds.
Mm.
So I hope it's a long track and it doesn't just melt them. So I thought maybe unmanned missions, but when I got to the end of the article, nope, they plan on sticking astronauts in there.
Wow.
It's not a terrible idea, because if they actually built it, it could greatly cut down on the amount of fuel the craft would need to get into space, allowing it to carry bigger payloads and save a whole lot of money as well. And for what it's worth, China isn't the first to consider the use of an electromagnetic space launch system.
Mm-hmm.
In the 90s, NASA started constructing a test rail that measured 50 feet long. It's not long enough. But due to the lack of funding and plenty of technical hurdles, the project was abandoned. Or was it?
Yeah. I mean, I feel there definitely is room for other methods of getting our ships to space. Calling it a gun is, it's an accelerator. Just, I don't know, call it something else.
Well, here you go. The U.S. military also developed lower speed electromagnetic catapults to launch planes from aircraft.
No, that doesn't make it better.
That doesn't make it better?
Yeah, there's a PR problem. It's just the whole way.
They did try one of those on the USS Ford aircraft carrier, but was plagued with problems. Mm-hmm. But what they also left out of the article is they do use effectively steam-powered railguns on aircraft carriers. So it's not that far-fetched. Yeah, again, catapults. That's what launches the planes off of. But it's all steam-powered.
Right, because there's not a giant runway on a carrier. That makes sense.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, done in practice, but to get it up to Mach 1.2, that's pretty ridiculous.
Yeah.
And then also, releasing the aircraft at the right moment has also proven particularly difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks to, they say, colliding shockwaves, amongst other things, I'm sure.
Oh.
That sounds so needlessly risky.
Well, if you're not putting people in it yet, it's the part where you want to put people in it that's the problem.
Right. And no, you know, not that much riskier to strapping people to a bomb. I mean, that's kind of what we do
exactly.
to get people into space now. And, you know, scientists have determined that the idea is still technically feasible and safe enough for astronauts to endure. That last part I'm not so sure about. But we'll see.
Well, I'm not an astronaut, so more power to you, man.
On that note, next link.
Next link.
All right. Well, I have a moderately scary, but also not that surprising one from GQ. It's called, "We regret to inform you that you may have email apnea and not even realize it."
Oh.
Email apnea.
So yeah, this is exactly what it sounds like. You know, sleep apnea is when you stop breathing at night. And email apnea is a very real phenomenon they have now documented where people tend to stop breathing correctly when they are checking and responding to emails.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man, yeah. I'm triggered right now.
And, you know, since most email is work-related and most work is stressful, people initially thought that this was really a stress response rather than a problem with email specifically. But psychiatrist Jasmine Sawney says no. Studies have shown that irregular breathing on the computer is mostly a result of heightened cognitive focus and happens just as often with non-work-related emails. What's more, those work emails might not actually be as stressful as you think they are in the first place, because when we start to breathe shallowly, our brain perceives from our physical state that we are in danger and stimulates a stress response based on that alone. Like, you think you're breathing that way because you're stressed, but in many cases, you're actually stressed because you're breathing that way. Mm. And, you know, if you do see an email that legitimately stresses you out, you can easily get into a feedback loop where the anxiety reduces your breathing, which it causes your brain to release more anxiety chemicals, which pulls back your breathing even more. And to be clear, this is sustainable for a short period of time, just like a fever or any other bodily response. The real problem comes when you spend most of your day on the computer. Yeah, like most of us. Or even worse, develop the habit of breathing shallowly even when you're not on the computer. Because breathing shallowly doesn't necessarily mean you're not getting enough oxygen. It definitely means you're not expelling enough carbon dioxide, which is a toxic waste product in the body. Habitually shallow breathing weakens the immune system, impacts long-term cognitive function, and can even lead to heart disease, even if your O2 level remains normal the entire time. So, you know, deep breath. What can we do about this?
Abolish email.
Yes, sure. Absolutely. We'll do that. Step one is, of course, to check in with your breathing while you're on your computer and do periodic breathing exercises to make sure you're really getting some deep breaths in there. If you can hold your breath for a few seconds at the peak without actually closing your airway and then breathe out slower than you breathe in, that will help reduce your carbon dioxide load and also strengthen your diaphragm muscles, which will lead to better habitual breathing habits long term. You can also do a lot with your posture, because slumping forward towards your screen curls up your abdominal muscles and encourages shallow breathing as well. There's also some pretty standard advice about maintaining a good work-life balance and meditating and setting aside a specific time to check emails, which, you know, is all well and good, but at some point it gets up there with diet and exercise. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously, our lives would all be better with major lifestyle changes, but who's going
to
do that?
Yeah, you mean I have to change everything?
Like, yeah, exactly.
You mean there's something wrong with our culture? I don't understand. I've been sitting very differently throughout this entire article.
I know. I found it kind of weird to breathe through this article. I keep being like, oh, okay. But yeah, the fundamental takeaway here, if there is something that you can change, is that anytime you're thinking but not moving, it's a potential problem. So, you know, if you can exercise while being on your computer, but I'm not going to do that. My chair is comfortable.
I just yell to myself, serenity now.
Actually, yelling, that would expand your lungs. That's good. Yell at yourself.
Oh, it's internal. It was internal yelling. So I actually have to spell it.
Okay. Or yell at your coworkers on the Zoom. Whatever. Whatever gets it going. All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include a brief history of the astronomer's chair, why clouds vanish during solar eclipses, and diamond is about to be dethroned as the hardest material ever. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on daminteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/daminteresting week. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.